Well, hello. You're listening to Hypocritical, a podcast by Hypocritic GG. I'm Lou, some call me Cheatspeak, and we have a fun one for you. Another review that is exclusive to the podcast here, expressive platformer Demon Tides from indie developer and publisher Fabraz. Let's get right into it. Our usual disclaimer up at the top. This review was conducted on SteamOS via a review copy provided by publisher Fabraz and Future Friends Games. The thoughts, impressions, and score contained here are entirely our own. We received neither editorial guidance nor compensation for this review from anyone associated with Demon Tides. We take great pride in offering unfiltered and uninfluenced takes on new releases, and we like to remind you of that. So let's get rolling. Also, important to note up front, the thoughts that we have here build on our pre-release impressions video of Demon Tides that's already available on our YouTube channel. If you subscribe to us, you may have seen it already. So full disclosure, many of our thoughts are going to reflect what we said in that pre-release impressions video, but be extrapolated across and put in the context of the full game. As it turns out, Act 1 was a pretty good representation of the entire experience, and you love to see that level of consistency throughout a game. So that is great. So what is Demon Tides? We'll start there. What the hell is even that? Let's talk about it. So Demon Tides is described by Fabraz as an expressive platformer, where the expressiveness kind of comes twofold. The characters themselves are actually expressive and, you know, have personalities and all these things, but players can also express themselves through the mechanics and the traversal that you naturally have when you're playing a platformer and going from place to place. So the goal is not so much just getting to the end, but defining how you get there and making that a major part of the experience. We'll talk about exactly how that manifests. As we mentioned, this is developed and published by indie studio Fabraz, and it is a sequel to their 2021 expressive platformer Demon Turf, and in our opinion, raises the bar from that title in pretty much every way and in every major facet of the experience. So what's it about? Well, fresh off of her quest to conquer the demon world, thousand-year-old demon child Beebs sets off on a new journey through the vast oceans of an area called Ragnar's Rock to find her father, who just so happens to be the king of the area. Isn't that convenient? With her kind of motley crew of quirky friends in tow, she sets out in a scrap-together boat that they sort of build on the fly to explore the world ahead and wrangle with whatever insane adventures they get themselves into, and they do get themselves into some pretty insane and dangerous adventures. So let's talk about the game structure and how it's all laid out initially. So it is very much an open-world platformer that, you know, from the top down is structured not unlike something like you might see in Sonic Frontiers, where you have a massive sprawling open area that's broken up by individual sort of more intricate platforming challenges that are corridored off in their own dedicated named play spaces, like individual pieces of platforming and landmass that you can fast travel to. These areas often have, you know, their own unique characters, their own unique visual styles, color palettes, platforming gimmicks to contend with, that sort of thing. And each, you know, have their own objectives, they have their own collectibles that you need to get, and have their own speedrun leaderboards, which is a major emphasis of the game we will get into. It's not all available at once. You can't just get off the boat and go anywhere that you want to go. It opens up, you know, over time, and chunks of the map reveal in sort of a three-act structure where you have Act 1 with a certain number, you get a few more in the next area, you get a few more in the next area, and the locations will reveal themselves on the map to be, you know, revisited in a fast travel sort of way as you visit them in person for the first time. Pretty standard stuff. There's dozens and dozens of these kind of standalone areas in total, and with all of these different collectibles to find and objectives to complete and speedrunning objectives to go after, you can spend a really significant chunk of time, like over an hour plus, plumbing each of these individual areas and still not finding all that they have in store. So there is a great density of content here, given, you know, the play space that you have. And that's always great to see. Progression requires the collection of your key collectible, which is Golden Gears, which you find by completing certain challenges across the open world in various ways and across various stages. There's 45 in total, and 35 of them are required to get to the end. So you don't need all of them, but you need most of them. So you basically need to handle most of what the game throws at you, with some exceptions. I think, you know, there's a 10 or 15 collection requirement for the first act to end. There's what, maybe 20 or 25 for the, you know, Act 2 to end and Act 3 opens up, something like that. So there's reasonable kind of progression gates as you go to open up new areas and have additional places to go look for these things. There's, of course, a ton of other collectibles, as you would expect from a platformer like this, including items, which you can spend on new outfits and other such cosmetics primarily, of which there are many. That's where that expressiveness comes in part. And talismans, which are additional abilities that you can apply to Biebs. And the more big bosses you beat, the more talismans you can apply at once. Each big boss that you conquer opens up an additional slot for you and you max out at 5. These modify Biebs' moveset and abilities and mechanics in small ways and large. Everything from adding additional jumps or different kinds of jumps, how different mechanics you have interact with each other, boost modifications when you're in boost mode, walking on water, reducing gravity. There's dozens of these, I think, that you can find. And, working out the specific combinations of them to define your own playstyle is a really important part of the experience, which we will talk about. There are dozens of outfit and cosmetics unlockables as well, as we discussed, and there's seemingly endless ways that you can combine all this stuff together to define your own specific play experience. And again, that kind of is the whole point with something like an expressive platformer. So how does it play? That's kind of the most important part, right? And I'm happy to report that even stretching past Act 1 and into the rest of the game, it plays really, really well. Platformers live and die primarily by kind of two main conceits, and the things that matter the most are your controls and your level design, and the game does both of these things really, really well. We're going to start with the former. Controls are really tight and really precise. It is exactly as responsive and interactive as you would expect from something like this, and where it demands precision and encourages you to get better and really leverage the mechanics, you kind of have to have that level of responsiveness and precision in there, so there's not a whole lot of guesswork or wiggle room. So it's very good that these, foundations are as solid as they are. There's predictable weight and physics for most, maybe though not all, movements, and it's generally really satisfying to just maneuver yourself around from place to place and platforming challenge to platforming challenge. There's not a ton of friction involved, although there is a bit. There's a term you may or may not have heard called shmovement that different, pieces of the game industry have applied to advanced movement or combo heavy games in all genres, which, if you think about it, is really just stringing a bunch of moves together in, flashy, stylish, or creative ways. So that's not exclusive to platformers. You can have first-person or third-person shooters that are very traversal-heavy. You think something like maybe Splitgate or Titanfall would certainly qualify. Even something like an extreme sports game, Tony Hawk, or Skate or something like that, where you have a bunch of these flashy moves you're putting together and using that to kind of get around. That's the basis of shmovement, and that's very much on display here. The game itself, and Fabraz as a studio, is very clearly trying to pioneer the expressive part of expressive platformer, and the flexibility in the mechanics is really a major part of that definition as far as the game expresses it. With so many ways to kind of combine those talismans like we mentioned before, and basically modify the rules with which you're out there platforming in the world, there is a lot of experimentation on offer, and it does give you that ability to almost instruct how you play to the game as you are navigating all these challenges. Something that comes to mind and is maybe a good reference point is something like Super Mario Odyssey. So if you've played that one, you know that it has a very low skill floor in terms of just getting to grips with the base movement and using that to get around. But the skill ceiling is very, very high in terms of how you can string the, cappy moves together and diving and jumping and spinning and all these different things. There's a lot of analogous mechanics usage here where it allows you to scale that skill ceiling about as high as you want to with, having triple jumps and spins and boosts and all these different things. The difference here, I think, is where Super Mario Odyssey is pretty much, the mechanics are what they are. Demon Tides lets you customize that experience in large ways and sort of define yourself how to get around and how you're leveraging and defining that skill ceiling, which I think is really interesting. Not everyone's going to engage with it in that way, but it is a major focus of the game and it very clearly wants you to. And that obviously helps when speedrunning comes into play, which is another major focus of any Fabraz platformer to date. Every area and distinct kind of platforming chunk of the world that you see has its own speedrunning leaderboards and rewards for completing its gauntlet. So it's kind of the perfect way to help you find or the perfect motivation, at least, to help you find the combo of abilities that best works for you and sort of leans into the specific way you prefer to play. You can use that as a foundation to get good at playing and get better and better each time you go for a slightly faster time. It helps breed familiarity and comfort with the mechanics that make a higher skill ceiling okay, because you sort of have the runway and the ability to get used to it at your own pace in that sense. Level design is the other key piece of obviously any platformer, and it is nicely varied throughout. The platforming often makes creative use of an area's particular theme or its main gimmick. So, you know, mechanized hazards for factories, natural dangers for caves and islands, very, you know, precise, treacherous jumping in high up precarious towers. It's all pretty thoughtful, and it's pretty immersive given the environment design on offer here and how much game there really is to traverse and sort of find your way through. There is a lot of variety given the scope of it, and the scope is pretty considerable. The challenge level does increase, obviously, as you move into the later acts and areas, but it does get very tough at points, even for those who do have a pretty good mastery of the controls and are generally experienced with platformers. There are often extended platforming gauntlets that you have to go through that are kind of one mistake and you're done bits with no save points, where this is kind of where the difficulty becomes most acute. And that may be sort of a make or break, separate the worthy from the not worthy kind of environment that, you know, may be challenging or too challenging for some. So it kind of depends on your perspective and how willing you are to kind of throw yourself at that kind of thing until you figure it out. The other interesting point mechanics-wise that's important to note, because it's both good and bad, is the checkpoint system. And checkpoints are entirely player-driven. So you manually place them down where you want them to be, and that defines where you reset to, where you either manually rewind to it and go back to it, or you die, run out of health, and you get placed back there. You can look at these all sorts of ways. That could be, you know, throw them before a very hard platforming challenge or after each, you know, distinct piece of a platforming challenge where you can almost, it almost feels a little save scummy, but it's a valid use of the mechanic and often helps ease the difficulty level if you remember to use the mechanic. It does take a little muscle memory to kick in and remember that. You could also place them at a high up vantage point, for example, that lets you boost to and explore parts of an area much faster than it was if you were on the ground and having to climb through each of these kind of specific areas. Now, I believe only one checkpoint can be active at a time, and it's not a foolproof system in terms of when you can and cannot use it, but we will get back to that. That's a major sort of overview of the mechanics. So the net of all of it is that it plays really, really well. So that is not a concern. Let's touch on the presentation and the world itself briefly. It's really well presented, in our opinion, with a soft, kind of almost cel-shaded vibe that gives it a distinct enough feeling and vibe, and that extends through to each specific, you know, distinct location and area that you visit. These platforming areas and locations, for the most part, have their own color schemes, their own environmental focuses, so it doesn't feel too repetitive, especially where different locations are kind of right next to each other when you're exploring for the first time. So that level of variety is really helpful and helps the player stay engaged over longer play sessions where you have many sort of different things to experience and you're not just going through the same, you know, open world plains or forest vibe like you might get with something like, to be fair, Sonic Frontiers or Halo Infinite or any open world environment that really just doesn't have the biome diversity to be interesting. That's not an issue here. Character designs, for the most part, are all very unique and kind of help reflect their own personalities. And given how much it leans into that motley crew and the cast that's around you, that's important. You know, you've got your outfit obsessed one, your gearhead one, your trend chasing one. It's all kind of fun. And they're all very distinct in that sense. You do get the occasional, let's say, well-endowed character that's kind of a humanoid or sort of human-like, and it's obviously designed that way on purpose, and, you know, that's one of those things you kind of just have to roll with. Otherwise, you know, it's a pretty thoughtfully and smartly designed crew of folks, so it's fun. The writing itself is very kind of quirky, loose, trendy of its era, meaning there's a lot of internet slang, there's a lot of kind of edgy, cool expressions and Gen Z-leaning stuff, things like that. You can read that kind of one of two ways. You can read it either as a kind of lighthearted and funny sort of way to present its story and its world, and it fits, again, with the behaviors of the characters. Or maybe it comes off as a bit sort of, you know, how do you do, fellow kids, and trying a little too hard, largely depending on whether you vibe with the whole general approach of the world or not. That'll kind of define which side of the fence you land on there. For us, the character design and the overall atmosphere, in our opinion, help skew it more toward the former, being lighthearted and funny and well executed, rather than the latter, but that's kind of up to you. The last little bit of the presentation that we love and that I thought was really interesting was this sort of shared world graffiti mechanic, which adds just this layer of personal and player-crafted flavor to everything around you in really, really fun ways. So basically, you can tag and spray paint kind of graffiti icons onto most game surfaces when you get there, and those kind of get uploaded to the game servers and can be seen by other players when they visit the same area. It's a really, really cute and unobtrusive way to add kind of a shared world element to a game like this without it becoming, you know, performance prohibitive or intrusive on your own kind of single player experience running through it. And it's just so, so much fun. You can leave a distinct icon somewhere knowing that other people will see it and sort of take that pride and knowing, oh, I got here and now there's proof of that. And you discover the same thing that other adventurers sort of left before you when you get to an area they've already been. It's a wonderful way to allow for, again, that level of player expressiveness and leaning into this idea that this is a world that is a little bit bigger than you and other people are living in it too, even if you don't necessarily see them. It's great. Now, it's not all kind of sunshine and rainbows here, and I want to touch briefly on a few of the elements that maybe don't work or aren't as clean as you would like. There are a couple of control quirks. For as great as the game is and for as well as it controls, there are some issues that can get in the way sometimes. Number one, defeating enemies or targeting objects with, I don't know how else to describe this, but as your Sonic Adventure homing attack, where you kind of lock in on a particular target and go rushing toward it, that almost always carries some degree of momentum with it, and it's not super predictable. So doing this in some locations risks you falling off of a treacherous platform, or worse, kind of barreling directly into some pit of goo that's a one-hit kill, and then you go back to the checkpoint you placed 15 minutes ago because you forgot that mechanic exists, right? That's a real situation that does happen. Sometimes you go careening past the thing that you're trying to hit. Sometimes you hit it and it knocks you backward. And it's sometimes just tough to see what to expect. So it is one point to note. Getting hit by something generally out in the world also often comes with significant knockback that can similarly displace you. And it kind of can serve to frustrate as well. Knockback is one of those really interesting design choices. It's been, you know, in platformers and adventure games all the way back to what the NES, think Castlevania, and how fun or not that was. It's not an inherently bad mechanic by itself, and it's something you have to account for and can add to the difficulty and flavor and feel of a game at a very core level. You take the knockback out of Castlevania, for example, that inherently changes how the game plays. In this case, though, it can and often does serve to make even simple mistakes sort of unnecessarily punishing, and the game has a very sort of get good attitude and pervasive mentality about it, and this sort of adds to that in a way that's almost a little bit too much sometimes. So it's, you know, something to consider. There are certain advanced mechanics like wall running that, at least in our opinion, are occasionally clumsy and a little bit difficult to pull off consistently, especially if you're in an area where the game is basically demanding that you do it successfully to get past a certain challenge or to get to the next checkpoint in a platforming challenge. And that can be tough. Now, again, is that just sort of a get good moment, figure it out? Maybe, but that's neither here nor there, maybe. Checkpointing is the other bit I wanted to revisit just sort of briefly, because it's not always clear when and where you can place a checkpoint. Sometimes it is predictable and you know that it's not going to happen. Like if you're in a dedicated platforming challenge in its own area that sort of like sucked you into it, yeah, you're probably not going to be able to set a checkpoint there. And that's part of the challenge of the area that's built into the design. But it would be nice if the game did a little bit more to kind of preemptively telegraph when you can and cannot throw down a checkpoint, because, you know, so much of the game is based around platforming in precarious areas that you can easily fall from and need to redo that would take you, you know, 3, 5, 10 minutes to get back to where you were. It introduces more friction than it should sometimes. You can combine that with something like, you know, knockback, and there you go. Progress through kind of area-specific challenges or objectives isn't saved either when you leave an area. So, you know, you do get frustrated by falling off of something for the fourth time and it wasn't your fault. And you had, you know, let's say you had an objective to collect 5 pieces of a gear. You have 4 of them. You go off and do something else. Oh, you forgot. Now all of them are gone. You got to go spend 20, 30 minutes recollecting them again. It's tough. So having to start those kind of particular objectives over and over again, if you leave an area and aren't able to finish them, is annoying. It sort of locks you into, you have to do this thing while you're here, and, you know, gets in the way of some of that open world fun a little bit, where you can't just really bounce around from thing to thing. We'll touch on the boss fights briefly. They're fine, I think, for the most part. And again, you earn talisman slots this way by defeating the big baddies throughout and maxing out how many you can have. And again, they start out pretty reasonable, but they do get pretty tough and gauntlety by the end, as you would expect from a game like this with the difficulty curve that it has and the mechanics focus that you see throughout. And this is sort of, you know, that opinion on difficulty as well. There are some breaking up and save pointing, especially toward the end and in the final boss. This sort of approach can be a turnoff and may be seen as, again, unnecessarily sort of frustrating or cumbersome, as other critics have noted. If you go out and read other opinions about this game, you'll likely see similar sentiments. But again, it's almost sort of a personal preference on how you like your boss fights and how Demon Tides handles them. I'll also briefly touch on performance as well. For the most part, it's excellent. But in our specific circumstances, there were some noticeable hiccups. So for context, you know, we, at least when I do reviews, they're typically done on some sort of PC handheld because that's just generally what I have access to. In the past, it was the Steam Deck. Currently, as I record this, it's a Lenovo Legion Go S, and those devices may change as time goes on. So Demon Tides, despite having a dedicated Steam Deck preset, does have some noticeable sluggishness in more open areas where there's lots on screen at once, especially when you're grinding or boosting at max speed. As you know, the game is loading things up in the open world, as a lot of geometry and objects are flying past you at once, yeah, you're going to see some slowdown. It's not game-breaking by any means, but it can interrupt the flow from time to time, and in, you know, responsiveness central sections where you need things to respond and you got to be doing a lot of actions quickly, it isn't ideal, especially, you know, given how precise and kind of timing-driven this game can be. Obviously, higher-end devices will likely not struggle in this way at all, so it is something to consider, but it's important to mention, I think, especially given how distinctly this game is targeting the sort of rapidly growing PC handheld market, because it is perfect for this. It is exactly that kind of game where you can hop into and just play for a bit on the go and just get immersed in for a little while and hop in and out of at your leisure. It is a perfect fit for something like a Steam Deck or whatever portable PC handheld you're playing this on. So it's something to consider nonetheless. Regardless, looking at it holistically, this is a really excellent 3D platformer, and it is very much worth your time. You know, it is clear that they put a lot of effort into sort of crafting all of this by hand and making, you know, a platformer that people can be as passionate about as they are. And Fabraz has really brought themselves to the forefront of this genre, especially in terms of you know, the fond memories it recounts for a lot of people. You think back to your Banjo-Kazooie generation, your Donkey Kong 64 collectathons, modern platformers with that, you know, sort of schmovement element in here. It is an excellent example of that. It's a great time. And this is the sort of thing where if you like the genre, if you can appreciate what indie studios are doing in this space to keep the genre fun and innovative and moving forward across time, it is an easy one to recommend and it is an easy one to support, you know, even if you just kind of casually like these games, or you do think it's a little cheesy, or is it really for me, give it a try. It is a lot of fun. It MSRP is currently for $25 US at full price. And even at that maximum price point, we think it's worth it. Sales over time will inevitably make it even more of a worthy buy. So it's definitely one that you should keep on your radar. The PR and information about the game advertises something like a 30 to 40 hour runtime for it as well. And that has to be considering like milking it for every kind of nook and cranny that it's worth. You will probably land more in like the 10 to 20 hour time frame if you're just doing the base collectibles, doing some side things, and moving through to the end credits. That's probably a more reasonable take on it. But needless to say, even that speaks to the volume of stuff that there is to do in this game. And there is a lot that you can sink your teeth into. So especially at the price, it is a really good buy. And if you have any affinity for the genre at all, this is one that should be on your radar. So, when you put it all together, Demon Tides gets 4 Gloobies out of 5. Despite its skew toward a more hardcore audience at times, its creative world building and joyously satisfying platforming mechanics make this a 3D platformer that's well worth your time and cements Fabraz, in our opinion, as masters of the genre. That's high praise. Demon Tides is available on PC now. A physical version combining Demon Tides with its prequel Demon Turf will be available for Nintendo Switch later in 2026. And again, that's a great move because that is a platform and that is a console that this is seemingly tailor-made for. It makes perfect sense. Keep it on your radar, folks. Hypocritic.gg is your hub for all things Hypocritic. Check out our live streams, convention coverage, video reviews, industry interviews, and more. And join our Discord community where you can react to topics we discuss here on the podcast and get the inside scoop on what's coming next from us. Thanks so much for listening. Stay fresh, cheese bags. We'll catch you back here real soon.